the hydrogen atoms would fuse. They would suddenly release massive amounts of neutrons, and that flood of neutrons would accelerate the fission of the uranium spark plug. It would also cause the uranium casing to fission. All of that would occur within a few millionths of a second, and then the metal canister holding everything together would blow apart. The physics and the material science behind the Teller-Ulam design were highly complex, and there was no guarantee the bomb would work. It relied on a concept, radiation implosion, that seemed plausible in theory but had never been accomplished. X-rays from the detonation of the first device, called the primary, would have to be accurately focused and reflected onto the secondary, the cylinder housing the fuel and the spark plug. Using X-rays to implode the secondary was a brilliant idea. The X-rays would move at the speed of light, traveling much faster than the blast wave from the primary. The difference in speed would prolong the fusion process, if the interaction of the various materials could be properly understood. The steel, lead, plastic foam, uranium, and other solids within the bomb would be subjected to pressures reaching billions of pounds per square inch. They would be transformed into plasmas, and predicting their behavior depended on a thorough grasp of hydrodynamics, the science of fluids in motion. The mathematical calculations necessary to determine the proper size, shape, and arrangement of the bomb's components seemed overwhelming. In addition to all the problems of fission, neutronics, thermodynamics, hydrodynamics, Ulam later recalled, new ones appeared vitally in the thermonuclear problems. The behavior of more materials, the question of time scales and interplay of all the geometrical and physical factors. And yet, the Teller-Ulam design had an underlying simplicity. Aside from the fusing and firing mechanism that set off the primary, there were no moving parts. In May 1951, a pair of nuclear tests in the South Pacific demonstrated that a nuclear explosion could initiate thermonuclear fusion. A device nicknamed George, containing liquefied tritium and deuterium, produced the largest nuclear yield ever achieved, 225 kilotons, more than 10 times that of the Nagasaki bomb. Although fusion was responsible for just a small part of that yield, radiation implosion did occur. The detonation of ITEM a few days later had a much lower yield, but enormous significance. It confirmed Teller's belief that fission bombs could be boosted, that their explosive force could be greatly magnified by putting a small amount of tritium and deuterium gas into their cores right before the moment of detonation. When a boosted core imploded, the hydrogen isotopes fused and then flooded it with neutrons, making the subsequent fission explosion anywhere from 10 to 100 times more powerful. Boosted weapons promised to be smaller and more efficient than those already in the stockpile, producing larger yields with much less fissile material. A full-scale test of the Teller-Ulam design took place on November 1, 1952. One of the world's first electronic digital computers had been assembled at Los Alamos to perform many of the necessary calculations. The machine was called MANIAC, Mathematical Analyzer, Numerical Integrator, and Computer, and the device that it helped to create, Mike, looked more like a large cylindrical whiskey still than a weapon of mass destruction. Mike was about 20 feet tall and weighed more than 120,000 pounds. The device was housed in a corrugated aluminum building on the island of Alugalab. When Mike detonated, the island disappeared. It became dust and ash, pulled upward to form a mushroom cloud that rose about 27 miles into the sky. The fireball created by the explosion was 3.5 miles wide. All that remained of Little Alugalab was a circular crater filled with seawater, more than a mile in diameter and 15 stories deep. The yield of the device was 10.4 megatons, roughly 500 times more powerful than the Nagasaki bomb. The Teller-Ulam design worked, and the United States now seemed capable of building hydrogen bombs. The war of the future would be one in which man could extinguish millions of lives at one blow, demolish the great cities of the world, wipe out the cultural achievements of the past, President Truman said a couple of months later during his farewell address. Then he added, somewhat hopefully, "Such a war is not a possible policy for rational men." The thought of using nuclear weapons may have seemed irrational to Truman, but a credible threat to use them lay at the heart of deterrence, and planning for their use had become a full-time occupation for many of America's best minds. Fundamental questions of nuclear strategy still hadn't been settled. Project Vista, a top-secret study conducted by the California Institute of Technology, revived the military debate about how to defend Western Europe from a Soviet invasion. In 1950, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, had agreed to create an Allied army with 54 divisions, enough to stop the Red Army, which was thought to have 175 divisions. The European members of NATO, however, failed to supply the necessary troops, and by 1952 the alliance seemed incapable of fielding anywhere near the requisite number. The small U.S. Army contingent in Western Europe served on the front line as a tripwire, a plate glass wall. American troops would be among the first to encounter a Soviet attack, and they'd be quickly overrun, forcing the United States to enter the war. The Strategic Air Command would respond by destroying most of the Soviet Union, but the Red Army would still conquer most of Europe, and civilian casualties would be extraordinarily high. The prominent academics and military officers who led Project Vista, including Robert Oppenheimer, concluded that Sachs' atomic blitz was the wrong response to a Soviet invasion. Bombing the cities of the Soviet Union might provoke a nuclear retaliation against the cities of Western Europe and the United States. Instead of relying on strategic bombing, the members of Project Vista urged NATO to replace manpower with technology, use low-yield tactical atomic weapons against the advancing Soviet troops, and bring the battle back to the battlefield. Such a policy might limit the scale of any nuclear war and save lives, preventing attacks on friendly cities. The field officers of the U.S. Army and the fighter pilots of the U.S. Air Force's Tactical Air Command, TAC, wholeheartedly agreed with the